Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor in Brussels.
And I'm Colm O'Mungoyne, RTE's deputy foreign editor in Dublin. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all of the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
This week, Donald Trump galloped into the Brexit debate, providing the usual mix of bafflement, non-sequiturs and U-turns, and in the process creating an enduring image of confusion on the face of Leo Varadkar when he likened the Irish border to the wall he dreams of building on the US-Mexico border.
And the president turned protocol on its head by backing Boris Johnson as the next prime minister and recommending that Nigel Farage join the UK's Brexit negotiating team.
Talking of which, we'll have all the latest on the Tory leadership campaign and that narrow Peterborough by-election win for Labour from RTE's London correspondent Fiona Mitchell.
And we'll assess how Europe views the latest Brexit manoeuvres on the Tory hustings, as well as the EU-US relationship in light of those remarkable D-Day commemorations in Normandy. But first, Fiona, the leadership campaign, not quite officially started, but out of the blocks at least.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, obviously, some people might say that this leadership campaign has in some form been underway for the last couple of years almost at this stage, but it will officially begin on Monday, 10 o'clock. Polls open, if you like, to start getting nominations in at least, and then they close at 5 o'clock on Monday evening, and at that point we'll know what the final figure is going to be. Now, when I say the final figure, of course, of people taking part in this, you may find that over the course of next week you have a couple of people who decide to drop out for whatever reason. At the moment there's a level 11 people running, and that is a very wide field, and there may be some individuals who perhaps think that it's in their better interests were they to drop out at an early stage and back one of the candidates, and then they might be in a very nice prime position for a prime minister or a ministerial post, should I say, when a new prime minister is appointed, if their individual gets the job. So everybody having to take those kind of things into account, lots of that going to be going on over the course of the next couple of weeks. Expect to hear lots about it next week, and then it hots up even further after that.
Yeah, it would have been expected maybe that a bad result for the Tories in the Peterborough by-election would have resulted on further pressure on Theresa May, but of course pressure on Theresa May is academic at this stage.
It is, of course, gone on Friday in a very, very low-key exit after all of the dramas of Brexit. She's gone as the leader of the Conservative Party. She will be remaining in place as a caretaker PM, but I think you can really put the emphasis on the word caretaker in that. You can already see it in terms of the interest in her, questioning her about various events over the course of the last 2 weeks that she said she's stepping away. All eyes have already turned to who's going to replace her. So she is there in that role of keeping things ticking over. She won't leave that until whoever takes over from her has been officially appointed. But as I say, really today, that day that she's stepping down as the Conservative Party leader, and no big hoopla about it. In fact, she wasn't even in number 10. She stayed in her constituency in Maidenhead today and just sent a letter to the 1922 committee to sign off on everything and tell them that yes, she is officially stepping down as Conservative leader.
Philip Hammond coming in to press the fiscal handbrake on any kind of promises of largesse or goodies to cement her enduring legacy. But of course, Brexit, the thing that defined her premiership, just how Brexity was that Peterborough election. We should point out to anyone who's listening to traffic noises in the background that Fiona is in a car in transit, we'd hasten to add, not driving as a passenger. But just how Brexity was that Peterborough by-election, Fiona?
Yes, well, it was really quite Brexity, as everything in British politics is at the moment, Colm. The Brexit Party, a lot of expectation that they might actually get their first MP elected in that by-election. And I mean, when you think about that, this is a party that is only a couple of months old. It really would have been quite spectacular. It didn't happen, but they did come second, just over 680 votes in the difference between Labour and the Conservatives. Now, this is a constituency that has always swung between Labour and the Conservatives. So pushing the Conservatives into third place, that is going to make a lot of people in the Conservative Party start to look at who do we need that could really tackled that Brexit Party issue, because if Peterborough proved anything, it proved that big push towards the Brexit Party that we saw during the EU elections, that wasn't just a one-off, that wasn't something that people were doing as a one-time only protest vote. There is still a lot of feeling about Brexit, and a lot of people from both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party moving to the Brexit Party. So it's a big concern for both of them. It must be said that it kind of, the vote and the turnout reflects the difficulties that the Brexit Party may have going forward in terms of getting MPs elected versus what it did with MEPs. It did see its vote share fall a little bit, as would be expected, I think around 7 or 8%. But as I say, 680 votes between it, I think it will have, for the Brexit Party, certainly proved to them that they may be on the cusp of doing this. That will give great heart to the Brexit Party, and it will give quite the shock to both Labour and the Conservatives.
And Tony, on that by-election, how closely would it have been watched from Brussels and by other governments? Because even though the Brexit Party didn't win, the Labour Party member that did win and is not of a firm, of the firm Remain variety. In fact, she's not joining up, Lisa Forbes is not joining up with the second referendum cohort of the Labour Party. So definitely swinging with the Peterborough constituency's pro-Brexit end of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are looking at Peterborough as further evidence that politics in the UK is very hard to read in terms of getting any decisive picture of where the country is going when it comes to Brexit, because yes, the Labour Party won, and Jeremy Corbyn can now go back to his somewhat muddled ambiguity on Brexit, because this was a 61% Leave voting constituency. I suppose that in itself is a bit of a question mark for Brexit. If the Brexit Party couldn't win in a constituency where 61% of people voted Leave, then you would have to ask questions of their ability to, you know, generate that hard, gritty work on the ground that is needed in a general election. I think, again, the European elections are a bit, something like, the sui generis. I mean, they are, you know, one of a kind. It's a very weird situation, but they don't seem to have been able to fully translate that into a parliamentary victory for Westminster. The Liberal Democrats again did well, but I think overall, you know, this shows that the Conservative Party have more to fear from the Brexit Party than Labour does. They were pushed into third place. The problem with Peterborough is that it could fulfil various theories about where the British government is going, or the British politics is going, and it could fulfil various theories about which candidate is best placed to win in the Conservative election campaign. But for the moment, Boris Johnson is sticking to this mantra that he's the only one who can beat both Nigel Farage and Jeremy Corbyn, and he will probably draw some satisfaction from that result in Peterborough. But again, you know, it shows that the centre ground is evaporating to the extremes. Everything is much more binary and black and white now in British politics, and you know that in turn does not augur well for the autumn, and that's really what EU capitals are really thinking about at the moment.
Fiona, the leadership race, when it starts officially on Monday, Boris Johnson is obviously the person that everybody, including Donald Trump, is mentioning as the front runner. But who else is trying to push ahead and make their presence felt? Rory Stewart is running an innovative social media campaign, but we also hear Dominic Raab's name being mentioned. What's his unique selling point?
Well, his unique selling point this week is that he manages to have stricken horror into the hearts of many in Westminster with his suggestion that he might prorogue Parliament in order to push through a no-deal Brexit. Now, it's something that nobody has been prepared to go near before, because it's
explain that if
just,
you would
saying that you're going to. Well, it would essentially mean kind of dissolving the Parliament, if you like, and saying that we're going to end this parliamentary session, so that it would mean that, you know, MPs would then not have their say. They wouldn't get the say in stopping a no-deal Brexit, which is something we know, of course, that MPs have done as much as they possibly can to. During the last session of Parliament, we saw, of course, people like Yvette Cooper, Oliver Letwin, working really, really hard to get amendments through that would take the idea of a no-deal Brexit off the table. But also, they know that there are still a long way to go before they actually have absolute say on that. Now, the idea of essentially dissolving the Parliament so that you could go into a second session and that they could take control of that, the government could take control of the process, which kind of argues against the old parliamentary sovereignty and taking back control that we heard so much of during the Brexit debate. That would be, the big fear would be that you would then be in a position where you might have the Queen dragged into a major, major constitutional crisis, essentially trying to push a no-deal Brexit through a Parliament which simply does not want that. There's not a majority in Parliament for that. So this suggestion from Dominic Raab managed to draw gasps from many quarters, because it has been considered essentially the nuclear option up to now. It has been talked about in the past, but nobody really suggesting they would go that way. But Dominic Raab absolutely pinning his colours to the mast of a no-deal Brexit and rowing in behind it. So he's been making headlines here this week, but probably for the wrong reasons, suggesting to many that he might be just maybe a little bit too radical, although it is an idea that some Brexiteers will be happy to hear, because ultimately what they want is that no-deal Brexit.
Dominic Raab, Tony, a name that, however badly people view Boris Johnson in Brussels and in other European governments, it's be careful what you wish for in wishing against Boris Johnson, because Dominic Raab is that other person that they really wouldn't like to see.
Yeah, I mean, there has been a bit of sentiment here in Brussels and other capitals about Dominic Raab, and I think he's certainly trying to play that up himself, and his supporters have been playing that up, this idea that he could stare down and did stare down Michel Barnier in the negotiations, and that he would be a lot more tough and, you know, wouldn't blink and would force the EU to reopen the withdrawal agreement and the backstop. And if not, you know, his threat of a no-deal Brexit would ring much more true, because he would project that kind of image of himself as a hard man. I mean, I think that is certainly taken seriously in Brussels, not to the extent where they would concede to any threat to reopen the or demand to reopen the withdrawal agreement, because they fear a no-deal situation, simply because they feel that Dominic Raab would come with a certain ideological conviction, and, you know, would really raise the temperature and raise the stakes and make a no-deal situation a lot more likely. I think they feel that Boris Johnson, because he, you know, he had a Remain background before the last stages of the referendum, that he might be more kind of, I don't know, clubbable or easily sort of dealt with by the other capitals. That,
clubbable in the baby seal sense, or easier to get on with?
Well, I'm sure there are some people who would make that analogy, but certainly not European capitals. I mean, I think that he is seen as a somewhat quixotic figure who might be more manageable, if you like, than Dominic Raab. But again, I mean, I think it's important to point out that there is widespread disbelief once again in Brussels and other parts of Europe that this is once again an exercise in the Conservative Party negotiating with itself, taking no account of the red lines of the European Union and taking no account of the red lines of the Irish government on the backstop and the depth of feeling in Ireland, both north and south, notwithstanding the DUP's position about the importance of the backstop. So, I mean, there's a feeling that these candidates are in an echo chamber, they're not well advised, they're surrounded by people who have no real connection with Brussels, who do not have contacts that they can call upon in Brussels. And there is also a feeling of a bit of a mischievous stream, perhaps, from the British side in Brussels, from British officials in Brussels, who are perhaps presenting a rosier picture to candidates in the Tory election party, the Tory election contest, than actually exists, and perhaps telling people that what they want to hear in terms of, well, the EU will of course, concede and make concessions because they don't want a no deal come September, October.
Right.
But certainly anybody that I've spoken to does not see any room at all for manoeuvre on reopening the withdrawal agreement or the backstop.
Well, maybe from both sides of the channel, you might give me your perspectives on the events surrounding D-Day, because there did seem to be a concerted effort where you were, Tony, in Normandy to reach out a hand of friendship. Perhaps Theresa May was being afforded quite a lot of collegiate sentiment, certainly by the French President Emmanuel Macron. Fiona, be interested in your perspective on how that went down in the UK, if at all. But Tony, give us the sense of what was going on in Normandy.
Yeah, so Theresa May was at one of the opening ceremonies on D-Day, on the 75th anniversary at Gold Beach, which is where most of the British fighting happened and the British landings happened 75 years ago. She unveiled a statue with Emmanuel Macron, and they laid the foundational stone of a new monument there. And Emmanuel Macron did talk very warmly about Theresa May being a friend, and you know how they'd worked together. I think that was a genuine gesture on his part. Obviously, from the luxury of him, you know, still being in power, I think people have seen that, despite the fact that he came second and his party came second in the European elections after Marine Le Pen and the National Rally, that you know his approval ratings are not bad. You know, they're around 41-42%. And he still did for someone who has a new party, relatively speaking, he did relatively well in the European elections. So, and I think this was an opportunity for him to really showcase France's power in the world, but also the very powerfully held views about the importance of multilateral international institutions that were really created on the back of the Second World War victory. And I think the fighting and the sacrifice on the Normandy beaches, is a very powerful, iconic symbol of the Allies, you know, endeavouring together and sacrificing lives together for a common ideal. And he spoke in that ceremony with Donald Trump at Omaha Beach, further along the coast, talking about the universal values and the promise of Normandy. And he, you know, attributed these universal values to the American founding fathers, in fact. So he was really offering Donald Trump a pathway back to international cooperation of the kind that he has, mocked and tried to roll back since he became president.
Right.
I think it was a very significant shift of emphasis or difference of emphasis between the two men. On the other hand, Donald Trump spoke more about the exceptional strength of America and its role in the world, and the fact that the Normandy D-Day generation had gone on to defeat communism, to establish civil rights in America, to revolutionize science, to put a man on the moon and so on. It was much more about how America was great once upon a time.
Fiona, Donald Trump also went on to invite Theresa May to stay on to strike a trade deal. How did that go down in the UK?
Yes, well, it was greeted by an awful lot of laughter by those in the room. We didn't directly see Theresa May respond to that, but I think we could probably all know that she has very definitely made her decision. And of course, as Tony was talking about Normandy there, well, the day before those events in Normandy, there was the commemoration in Portsmouth, which of course was one of the last events, the last events that Donald Trump attended on his state visit to the UK. The emphasis there very much, I mean, similar to what Tony was saying, very much on unity, very much on the idea of acting together and the strength that there is in solidarity. The Queen, who appears to be Donald Trump's new best friend, also giving a speech at that, and the President himself reading a prayer. But that was rounding off that three-day visit, which I think overall a sense that it went well. Yes, were there a couple of clangers in the middle of it? Yes, absolutely there were. It didn't start too well with huge criticism of Sadiq Khan. But quite frankly, these things are all relative, and that in overall terms it could have gone an awful lot worse. Certainly the American president seemed to be very happy with how it had gone, very, very impressed with the literally the royal treatment that he got in that state banquet, and this was the all the bells and whistles visit, and he certainly seemed to enjoy all the bells and all the whistles.
I think there was a sense of both sides in the Brexit debate trying to lay claim to the legacy and meaning of D-Day. On the one hand, you had Brexiteers talking about, you know, Britain's place in the world is really alongside America, just like on the Normandy beaches, and, you know, once we've left the European Union, we will be entering that Anglosphere, that that transatlantic trading kind of dream world that some people somewhat fantasize about. And on the other hand, you had people taking D-Day as the example of multilateral solidarity and cooperation, of which the European Union is the ultimate expression. But I think ultimately, I don't think people really wanted to drag D-Day into the Brexit debate that much, but you could see how it was creating a little bit of froth at the beginning of Donald Trump's visit.
It's one of those things that plays into really both narratives when it comes to Brexit. And you really could get a sense of people desperately trying to stay away from the idea of dragging it, as you say, too much into the ongoing Brexit debate. But it didn't. It is one of those things that no matter what, everything, every speech, every prayer that was read had some sort of resonance, and particularly with the President of America in attendance, and particularly with the kind of discussions that are going on at the moment. If there was a debate about whether this was aimed at Brexit, whether it was aimed at Donald Trump, or whether it was aimed at a little bit of everything.
Fiona, I don't know whether that's your phone or the driver's phone there, but while we still
no,
have you...
No, that's the driver's phone that's going off.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, sorry. The NHS...
Well, he's obviously gripped by the conversation we're having, so
he's not answering
his phone.
Exactly.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. Yeah, you can completely tell, can't you? Yeah.
The NHS, Fiona, did come up. Donald Trump's visit to the UK was relatively controversy-free, apart from, as you say, and there's always going to be an apart from in that, but apart from the war of words with Sadiq Khan, but also the NHS came up for mention, whether or not it would be on the table in any future trade negotiation when the US and the UK were negotiating one-to-one with obviously considerable asymmetry in that negotiation.
Yes, it was raised at the press conference on Tuesday on foot of comments that had been made by the US ambassador, Woody Johnson, the US ambassador to the UK. He had been asked about whether or not the NHS and access to the NHS for American companies would be something that would be crop up as part of a trade deal. He sort of said, yes, everything's on the table. So understandably, that was also asked of the US president, who said, yes, yes, it's on the table, and then took a few hours to think about it and came back in an interview with Piers Morgan the next day to say, no, it's not on the table. That's definitely not trade. That's a separate thing. Of course, the idea of going anywhere near the NHS, is the absolutely iconic NHS, was something that horrified an awful lot of people. And, you know, comparing the NHS and the American healthcare system, even more horrifying for a lot of people here. So a lot of rowing back from the US president on that. But there was rowing back in a number of areas. And I think we're we've seen that this tends to be his modus operandi, if you like, that he'll say something and then a couple of hours later say, no, I didn't really mean it. There was a lot of ongoing discussion about comments that he made about Meghan Markle, the Duchess of Sussex, and whether he may or may not have called her nasty. I think everything was left ambiguous enough in that he had a little bit of wriggle room to get out of it, and people had enough wriggle room to criticise him for it. And I think when he wades into these kind of things, you almost now have to factor in waiting a couple of hours to see what he says in a subsequent interview or what he puts on Twitter and how he may row back from it.
How far are you from the journey's end there at the moment, Fiona? How many more minutes would you say?
About three or four minutes, I'd say.
Okay. Will we take our leave of you now then, or are you happy?
Excellent. That sounds like a good plan.
Okay. We'll talk to you next week, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry about this,
not
guys.
At all.
It's
That's
been a
fine.
Bit of a mad one.
No. Okay. Thanks a million, Fiona. All right.
Take care.
Chat
see
to you
ya.
Next
bye.
Week.
See
bye.
You, Fiona.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Okay. That's Fiona. Thanks for that, Fiona. Tony, then, with one mighty leap, the president was free to go to Doon Beg and straight into the issue of the Irish border, something you know a little about.
Yeah, I mean, this was an extraordinary moment, I think, among many in the Brexit process, where Donald Trump arrived, I think, in Shannon, where he met the Taoiseach.
Yeah, they had the impromptu press conference there, yeah.
Yeah, and in remarks that will live forever on Twitter, he appeared to liken the Brexit problem on the island of Ireland with his own issue on the border with Mexico. And he talked to the press with Leo Varadkar sitting there looking increasingly uncomfortable about, you know, your problem with the wall, with the border, your wall. He even mentioned the military at one point, and nobody seems to understand what that reference was to. But overall, he sort of had this breezy attitude that, oh, everything will be fine, it's going to work out great. You know, it's like we were all embarked on a day trip and different people were looking at different weather apps as to whether our picnic might be rained off, and he was saying everything will work out fine, don't worry, to the growing disbelief of Leo Varadkar sitting beside him. In fact, I spoke to one official in the European institutions today who had been on a course this week on non-verbal communication, and they said that during the course they spent half an hour discussing Leo Varadkar's face at that impromptu tête-à-tête in Shannon.
That's quite the course.
As an example of non-verbal communication.
Right, the face that launched 1,000 PowerPoints.
Exactly. So
I suppose in fairness, he doesn't have an influence on the process itself, other than by his promises of a comprehensive trade deal with the UK. He encourages those elements within the Conservative Party that say it'll be all right after departure, and that the loss of trade with Europe will be more than adequately compensated by in any future trade dealings with the United States or other large global economies.
Yeah, I mean, like, people talk about Donald Trump's influence on the Brexit debate, and they refer back to Barack Obama's intervention before the referendum, saying he supported the UK staying in the European Union, and that in the event of Brexit, the UK would be at the back of the queue. So therefore, it's perfectly fine for Donald Trump, from a different political persuasion, to have a different view. But, you know, he's been this extremely irritating presence for Theresa May. He's openly criticised her Brexit policy, her negotiation skills. He's openly sided with people like Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson. And I think it was interesting this week that Boris Johnson seemed to want to distance himself somewhat from Donald Trump, because, Trump's presence reinforces those divisions within the UK. And, you know, there is a risk for someone like Boris Johnson, if they align themselves too closely with someone like Donald Trump, then they will lose the metropolitan voter, the potential soft Brexit.
The one nation Tories.
The one nation Tories, exactly. So it's been a very difficult manoeuvring for people like that. But at the same time, the The economic rationale for Brexit is almost exclusively built on the UK negotiating free trade agreements around the world, and the most important one is with the US. And so it is a clear issue that people can't necessarily pussyfoot around. But again, there is a very strong critique against this idea that a US trade deal would make up for the depth of trade that currently exists between the UK and the EU, with the UK part of the single market and the customs union. So, I mean, this is going to be a very big issue, you know, if and when Brexit happens. And just on the question of the NHS, US-owned companies actually do operate within the European Union, and that is permitted so long as they have an EU presence. For example, in the UK, there's the Priory Group, which provides mental health services in the UK to the NHS. And you know, a lot of the NHS operates on services that are provided by the private sector. It's a US-owned company, and it provides services. Those services are permitted. But the question of whether the US would include the NHS in a future free trade deal and would provide cheaper medicines for UK citizens and consumers. I mean, I think that is questionable, because
it's unlikely the
US pharmaceutical.
Yeah, the pharmaceutical presence here has always insisted that part of the agreement in terms of medicines is that the Irish buy non-generic products in order to support the investment of the US here. They've been quite overt about that in their correspondence with the Department of Enterprise, particularly when medicine prices are being renegotiated between the department and the Department of Health and the pharmaceutical industry.
So the Irish example is I think a salutary point for people who think that a trade deal with the US that would include the NHS would mean cheaper medicines for UK consumers. I mean, overall, this is a very toxic issue, and again, it speaks to that polarisation with people who think that the UK is so much better trading with its next door neighbour. The whole gravity argument about international trade, where it's, you know, the country that is closest to you tends to trade more with you, and that the US will never make up for the shortfall caused by the trading losses due to Brexit because of certainly the non-tariff barriers, the geographical distance, and so on. So that's an argument that will run for a while.
So what's on the Brexit agenda for the coming week or so? Obviously, the Tory leadership battle will be one of the things that will be occupying people's interest. But anything happening in your neck of the woods?
Well, not really Brexit. I mean, at the moment, all the focus is on the top jobs. So we're still waiting to see who will get to be the next president of the European Commission, the next president of the ECB, the European Council, who takes over from Donald Tusk, the president of the European Parliament, and the EU's foreign policy chief who gets that job. Now, this has become a very complex and political problem for the EU, given that there was no clear-cut winner of the European Parliament elections in terms of a political grouping within the Parliament that can lay legitimate claim to getting the top job of President of the Commission, for example. So what they've done is the political groups within the European Parliament themselves have gone off to try and figure out, first of all, can they work up a legislative content package first before they start trying to attach a name to that. And also, leaders from the European Council have formed their own little clusters according to their place on the spectrum. So the socialists have Pedro Sanchez from Spain and Antonio Costa, the Portuguese leader, who they've gone off to talk among themselves and to talk to the parliament about, you know, a programme and, you know, who gets what job. But the names of these of the main candidates are still there, but they still haven't been hooked on to a particular post that will become vacant. So again, we've got people like Manfred Weber, who's the EPP's lead candidate. I think, I've made this point before, I think most people assume that he will probably not get the job because he simply doesn't have that command of support across the European Parliament or across other capitals, mainly because he hasn't held high ministerial office. On the social side, you've got Frans Timmermans, a current commissioner and a former Dutch foreign minister who's multilingual, had a very good...
Speaks Russian, I think, fluently.
Yeah, and also I think, you know, his party in the Netherlands did very well. They came first in the European elections against all the odds, and people think that was actually an example of where the Spitzenkandidat process actually did resonate with voters, because he had been very high profile on the campaign to be the lead candidate for the socialists and to be the next commission president. Again, the gender issue is very, very important. So we have people like Margarethe Vestager, the liberal candidate who has for the first time been acknowledged by President Macron of France, because his party is going to be aligning themselves with the Liberal group in the parliament. And they did pretty well, exactly, as well. So she can't be excluded either. And then you have the question of Michel Barnier. That's a big question in terms of Brexit, because if he gets the job of Commission President, then that would be a little bit of Groundhog Day, I think, for the Brexiteers in the UK. If they do get the withdrawal agreement over the line, he would be the Commission President when they were negotiating the trade deal and the future relationship. So that would be a fairly uncomfortable process.
But they already have a bit of deja vu there, because obviously Martin Selmayr remains Secretary General of the Commission, and Sabine Vaand is going to head up the trade end of things.
The trade division, DG Trade, so she Sabine Vaand is going to be in a very prime pole position in those negotiations. We discussed this last week on the podcast. But the thing is, if Emmanuel Macron insists that Manfred Weber, a German, doesn't get the job of Commission President, then I think that will weigh against Michel Barnier getting the job. You know, I think it's one thing for Macron to veto Weber; it's another thing for him to get a Frenchman in the position of Commission President. So that's really going to be the next big thing. And again, we have been told that they're hoping to get this process all worked out by the June European Council in a couple of weeks' time. But my suspicions are that they won't have worked through all of the competing, the balancing, as they call it, between big and small countries, left and right, north, south, east, west, and so on, in time for the June Council. So I think this could drag into the summer somewhat.
Well, I suppose that's it for another week then, Tony.
Yeah, that's it for this week, Colin. We'll have a lot more of Brexit and top jobs and general stuff next week on Brexit Republic. So from me, Tony Connolly, in Brussels, thanks for listening.
And from me, Colin Mahungan, in Dublin here. Thanks for listening.